Mr. Collins, Reel 3.
So we're eating pemmican and different things and working in the mountains of in the Cairngorms. Went back to London and Andrew said, "You come with me to Denmark." And actually the war finished the day I went into Denmark. So nothing much happened there. I just had a while to set, worked in London for a couple of weeks, I think. And I was sent back to England. And Andrew was going to follow me to England. So when I got to London, I had to go to SOA headquarters, Baker Street, you know. And they said, we're looking for radio operators, we're short of radio operators. Would he go to Far East? So I said, yes.
What had happened? Did you go? You went to Denmark, though?
Oh, yes, yes.
How long were you there?
Just about a fortnight, 3 weeks.
What did you see in Denmark?
Nothing. There's nothing there, no Germans there. At least not that I saw. And I was just in the Palace Hotel in Denmark. And Andrew was meeting met various people, resistant people, you know. But that's all.
But you volunteered to go to the Far East.
Yeah, but I got back.
Why did you do that?
Well, I still work to do. And I knew I'd be going among other SOE people. You know, that was the type of work I'd been doing. So they sent me home, said, take some leave. I was home 3 days. And they sent a telegram to report back. The next thing I knew was on an aeroplane, flying to the Far East. So it was in York, I think, because we flew to Malta, flew to Cairo, Bombay, Colombo, Ceylon. And Colombo, Ceylon was MA-25, which was 4736. I did some training there, 4736, and I met these two officers I had to go with, Captain Major Peter Maxwell, Lieutenant John Prosser. Peter Maxwell's father was, I believe, Governor General of Kenya, because he went back to Kenya after the war. Anyway, I met these two, and they said, we're going, you are our operator, we'll go to Malaya. So eventually we got an aeroplane. I think it was an American Liberator, because it was a long way to go non-stop. You see, it had to take us to Ceylon, to Malaya, from Ceylon, and come back without stopping. Because we parachuted into the jungle in Malaya. And we got there about midnight. And the reception committee were waiting for us, which was Chinese blokes. But there was a Lieutenant Colonel Broadhurst, Dougie Broadhurst. And his operator was called John Smith. They had arranged the place where we had to drop. So we dropped there and met them, and they took us to the camp that is established in the jungle near Kuala Kubo, a small village, not a big one.
Is this in Johor?
No, Salanga. About 40 miles north of Kuala Lumpur.
Which month do you think that you dropped in?
Which month, sorry?
Which month do you think that you dropped in to the Malayan Jungle?
Month. It was the end of June, but then beginning of July.
And the drop went okay?
Oh, no problem.
And you had a reception committee?
Yes, the Chinese were waiting for us, you know, lit the fires and that sort of thing.
How close were you to the fires?
Oh, no more than 50 yards. Very good drop.
And how many of you dropped in?
Three. Two officers, myself. That was all.
What special equipment did you take with you?
We had the containers which dropped by parachute as well, of course. But I had radio set, naturally. But the marvellous thing was how I was supposed to charge the batteries. You can realise if you're in the jungle, middle of the Malayan jungle, there's no electricity, there's nothing. You know? It's a wireless set. Well, how do you use batteries? Well, the battery, instead of being filled with normal acid, was filled with a jelly acid, so it wouldn't spill. That was the first thing. The second thing was, I had a portable donkey engine. It's only about 6 inches long, in a metal canister, which is a boiler.
6 inches long?
Yeah. You probably see them now, toys for the kiddies. I should boil the water in this pot with a lid on. And when I boil the steam, dumb tube, on the donkey engine. Spin the wheel and the donkey engine used to go. And on the end of it, I had a little generator, you know. And it used to charge the batteries with that. With that, I thought that was marvellous.
It worked all right?
Yeah, no problem at all. I got through. The second night, I made contract with Colombo. And it worked okay all the time till we packed up, till the army eventually came in September, because the Japanese didn't surrender in August, you know, in Malaya.
Did the Japanese get close to you?
They chased us a couple of times, and we had a skedaddle up the hills a bit, you know, but they didn't catch us. Because yes, I had to send the code. I was busy on the radio at the time, and one of the Chinese ropes said, "Yapong, Yapong." So I had to send QUG, which means I'm closing down, I'm under fire, more or less, you know. Anyway, the Japanese surrendered, but we went into Kuala Kubu itself and hid in the station. You know, watch the trains coming through from northern Malaya. Full of Japanese troops are all going down to surrender. We then decided, Major Maxwell anyway, went into Kuala Kubu, there's four of us, four, forget them all. Peter Maxwell, John Prosser, two officers, myself, and Sergeant Chin Bing Lee, Chinese Canadian interpreter. Went into Kuala Kubu and approached a Japanese barrack there, like a big place they had, you know, an encampment. And with the help of the interpreter, we arranged for the Japanese to surrender. and we took the surrender ourselves, the four of us, when all the Japanese officers and warrant officers and whatnot had a run up, put the pistol on the ground, take off the sword, put that on the ground, salute and run back. And we did that with them all.
This was at Kuala Kubo.
Kuala Kubo. And we, at that time, we went into Kuala Kubo ourselves and lived in the district commissioner's bungalow, which, you know, before the war, the district commissioner. We lived in the bungalow and we organised the rice distribution, and I got some drops, airdrops, you know, the Army of the Iron Nation. See, during the time we were in the jungle, we were getting drops of ammunition, clothes, arms, and it was obvious some of the containers kept missing. If we're supposed to get 8 containers, probably only got 7. Realised, we did, that the Chinese were all red hot communists. I mean, we had to wear red stars, 3 red stars on the shoulder, you know. And I was got into trouble after the war. And they were hiding arms in the jungle. So...
was there anything that could be done to stop it?
Nothing at all. I mean, we had about 120 Chinese. We guessed what was happening, but and the army didn't arrive until September.
Whilst you were with the Chinese forces in the jungle, what kind of nuisance to the Japanese did they make themselves?
They're making patrols, and I'll be perfectly honest, very little nuisance to the Japanese, because of Kuala Kubo. They knew we were there. Kuala Kubo was a big place. Yeah. I don't think I'm much good at all, to be honest.
The Chinese, you mean?
Chinese, yeah.
Why was that?
Well, I don't think of the type. Sure, the soldiers, you know, the boss man of the Chinese was one of these haughty. Had them all under his thumb, and every year they got a lecture on communism. You know, they didn't do much at all against the Japanese. We did all the walking about and looking for patrols and that sort of thing.
Whilst you were there, did they ever ambush the Japanese?
No. Not to my knowledge. No one know.
Did they shoot the Japanese up whilst you were there?
No. I mean, I don't think it really left the camp very much at all. I think they were mainly intent that the war would finish, they would take control of the civilian population and Kuala Kubo, and they'd take control of everything, and they'd be the masters. That was the idea.
Do you remember any other Chinese by name whom you were with?
Yeah. Feng Chun was the leader. And this lad, I had a photograph actually of sending this fella who wrote to me, you know.
Who was writing a book?
No, he's in a sort of medal society or something. and he's making a section of his, for himself on the SOE. I've sent him all sorts of things, you know. And I've sent him a photograph of Fung Chun, and Fung Chun took part in the victory parade in London.
Any other individual Chinese you remember?
Just a small one called we call him Charlie. He was a cook. He used to boil the rice. I don't really know the names.
What was this Fu Chang like?
Very, what should I say, autocratic. He always seemed to be imperious, you know. He was the boss and that was it. They got the order from him.
So you were telling me what happened after the Chinese surrender.
Japanese surrender.
The Japanese surrender.
Yeah.
Can you tell me what happened to you then?
Well, it surrendered. And we, as I say, were looking after Kuala Kubo. We took the surrender of the Japanese in Kuala Kubo. And we sent a motor car, which took the Japanese, and a lorry. And I took a lot of rations, rice and stuff for the population, you know. Because I had it all by then. In one big go down, a big place to put all the rice in so it wouldn't get back marketeers and all sorts. Then, we had a sort of headquarters set up in Kuala Lumpur. And actually, we did nothing, just enjoy ourselves more or less. Until December, and they sent us back to Ceylon, but kept the headquarters in Kuala Lumpur. We sent back to Ceylon. The was stay there for a month or 6 weeks in Colombo, and they informed us that the SOE had been disbanded. And we had to sign the official secret act a couple of times, and we were all sent back to our various regiments. Mine was the Royal Signals, of course. I was sent to Mau, which is a signals depot in India. And at Mau, they couldn't do anything with us. See, it was a training school for signals. And we were already very well versed in radio. And nothing you could teach us. I said, well, we can't do anything with you. So everybody was then sent to different units around India. I was sent to Delhi Cantonment. Palam Airfield with the first Indian Air Formation Signals. I was the only British senior NCO. There's about 200 Indians of all kinds, you know, Mohammedans and everything, Punjabis, Sikhs. And there was three linemen and one vehicle mechanic. I should take this parades for all these Indians, you know, regimental parades. And we ran telephone lines and made communication from Palam Airfield to Delhi. Mumbatan's headquarters in Delhi. And then they started the several disobedience Indians. And we were laying down for all night, and they were digging them up the night time, and we were laying and digging them up, you know.
Where was this?
In Delhi. Delhi Cantonment. The lines between GHQ, Delhi, and Palam Airfield, which was a Delhi airfield.
Were any of the people responsible caught?
No, we never. Well, we don't know. We were just putting lines in and putting the communications on, you know, because Mountbatten had his headquarters there and his plane was to land on Palam Airfield.
Did you see anything else of the civil disobedience in India?
No, that's all I saw. Was weird. It, we never really went to the Delhi very much. I went to see the Taj Mahal and that sort of thing. But a filthy place. Place I wouldn't be seen dead in.
How did you get home then?
Well, they told me I was due for release. They sent me to Delhi. That's an army camp. That you have to stay there till the boat comes in. Well, it was delayed, so I was there 6 weeks. And that had brought me home, and Queen of Bermuda was the ship.